You're listening to the Pandemic Podcast. We equip you to live the most real life possible in the face of today's crises. Ooh, I'm winded. Sorry, I came up from the basement. My name is Matt Bodker, and I'm joined with my one good friend, Dr. Stephen Kissler, an epidemiologist at the Harvard School of Public Health. How are you, fine sir?
Hey, I'm doing all right, Matt. How are you doing?
Doing well. Apparently, I need exercise because we were getting ready to record, and the door to the basement upstairs was open, and I could hear my boys screaming and jumping wildly, and so I wanted to solve that. So I ran upstairs to quick close it, and now after 5 seconds of moving, I'm absolutely winded, and I need to take a nap.
Man, don't we all need a nap at this point? You know, we're just anybody who's listening to this who's like trying to decide between listening to the podcast and taking a nap, take the nap first.
Take a nap. Hey, you know what? We might even be able to lull you to sleep, right? With our talk, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
If you're having a tough time, plug us into your ears and you'll fall fast asleep and have COVID dreams, which I don't know if that's a dream or a nightmare. Well, thanks for joining, everybody. We're glad to be back. We took a break last week, and there was a reason for that because, well, Dr. Mark, like usual, couldn't join us. And Stephen was going crazy with some Delta research. And so he was burning the midnight oil. I thought it's only good for us listeners, to give him some time to do what he does best, which is great news for us this week, which means we get to chat about what he has found, talk about this pre-pub that might be going out today or already has. He's let me know. Before we get to that, let's do the basic stuff. That is number one. Please leave a review. We got a couple. I was going to do both of them, but I didn't have time to snapshot them. Maybe I can pull it up really quickly. But we have one from JKGUHCDF. That's a really profound name. 5 stars. I learned so much from this podcast. I look forward to every episode and usually listen to them more than once because they are so much information to absorb. Thanks for all you do. You're absolutely welcome. It's my pleasure. I learn so much every time I'm on here because I'm the one with all the questions and I get them answered. I'm the lucky person in this podcast. Another one from Renee Bird on August 10th. This is the best podcast out there on the pandemic. The three hosts are intelligent and well-spoken. The discussions are based on science and real-life experience. I'm a registered nurse. Therefore, what I most especially appreciate is that the information is not dumbed down or scripted. There's very little political opinion expressed. It is clear the topics are well-researched. Keep up the great work, gentlemen. Marine from Philly. Marine, thank you so much. There's more she says on here, but thank you so much for making that review. It's so helpful. So if anybody else can, please do. It keeps us going. It keeps us motivated. Yeah. Well, not so much me. It motivates me, but Stephen and Mark, the ones who do the heavy lifting, it keeps them lifted up and going strong.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
And if you can support us in other ways, $5, as little as $5 a month at patreon.com/pandemicpodcast. Or a one-time donation, Venmo, PayPal, all in the show notes. We'd love to have your financial support to keep this going. And I think that's all the good stuff. So let's get right into this, Stephen. I have a handful of questions, and it's been 2 weeks now, and I've seen a number of headlines pop up that just I wanted to discuss with you. But it sounds like from what we talked about before we got on, we might be able to get most of this addressed through your pre-pub that we're talking about. So let's go straight into this. We didn't get you last week. There's a reason for it. Share like what's going on, what motivated this research, and what kind of things you guys have found.
Yeah, so this is sort of version number 3 of a ongoing study that we've been working on. So this is a study that's been following a cohort of individuals, and they've been tested for COVID very regularly. As often as we can, we're doing it every day. And this is with what we call quantitative PCR tests. So when you get tested for COVID normally, unless it's one of the rapid tests, you're getting tested with PCR. And one of the benefits of that is what that gives back is that actually doesn't just give you a positive or negative, but it actually gives you this sense of how much virus is in your body. Now, when you yourself get tested, you usually only get that positive or negative result. But on the back end, there's this continuous number that tells you basically how much virus was in the sample. So since we've been following this cohort of people over time, and they're getting tested whether or not they're sick, whether or not they're showing symptoms, inevitably some of them do get infected. And what you get to see with that is you see sort of the entire trajectory of the viral load in their body over time. So you can see it. Basically, what it looks like is it sort of looks like this little triangle where it just sort of goes up and then reaches a peak and then comes back down. And then sort of sometimes you get these sort of low level positives that sort of linger for a while when your body's sort of spitting out viral fragments as it's recovering. But by and large, it's basically actually this really remarkably simple increase and decrease in viral load as the virus sort of takes off in your body, and then as your immune system takes over and fights it off. So why is that important? Well, one of the things that allows us to do is to look at how those, what we call viral load trajectories, differ between people. And so one of the things we've been looking at is how they differ between different variants. So looking at the alpha variant, the delta variant, the previous variants, and looking at how it differs between vaccinated and unvaccinated people. Now, why does that matter? Well, if we have an understanding of how these viral trajectories look, we can get a sense for how long the infection lasts, which has implications for how long people need to quarantine. We can get a sense of if people who are infected with different variants produce more virus, which might mean that they're more infectious. We can get a sense of if vaccinated people clear the virus more quickly, which would give us a sense of why vaccinated people might not be as transmissible as unvaccinated people. So all of these things sort of underpin a lot of our understanding of what drives the spread of COVID-19 and what we can do to prevent it better in sort of finer and finer categories of people. So what did we find? Well, I mean, as I mentioned, the main axes that we've been looking at this on are comparing alpha, delta, and sort of non-variants of concern, and then comparing vaccinated and unvaccinated people. So one of the things that we found was that there's actually not a lot of difference between the variants in these viral trajectories. So whether you're infected with alpha, delta, or non-variants, according to the data that we have, you basically produce similar amounts of virus in similar amounts of time, and you clear it basically equally quickly. Now, that contrasts with some recent findings. You know, there was that study that we talked about a little while ago that said, you know, people who are infected with Delta are 1,000 times, you know, they produce 1,000 times more virus. The more we dig into that study, the more I am not totally convinced that that's the case. There have been a lot of other studies that suggest that the peak viral loads are similar. Not many have reproduced that sort of orders of magnitude higher viral concentrations.
Okay.
So, and this happens all the time in science. You know, it depends on how you analyze the data. It depends on where the data is coming from. And that's why it's really important to have a lot of different studies looking at this from different angles so that we can reach some kind of consensus.
Yeah.
So that's what we're aiming to do with this piece, is sort of reach some kind of consensus here. So, okay, so we find that the variants have similar viral trajectories. Well, then how do we account for the fact that alpha, it was more infectious, and that delta is even more infectious than that?
Yeah.
Well, one of the key things that seems to be in play here is that it actually probably has something to do biologically with the virus itself and how strongly it binds to our mucosal cells, basically. So
mucosal cells, what are those?
Yeah, so those are like, yeah, mucus, exactly. It's like what gives you a snotty nose. And so basically the virus's first point of entry into our bodies. And so it can probably bind more strongly to those, which makes it more infectious. And so even though you're producing the same amount of virus, that means that it takes less virus to create an infection. And so that's one of the places that we get the difference in infectiousness. Now, the other thing is that with these viral load trajectories, we've been measuring them from the nose, from nasal swabs. But, you know, the human body is a pretty complex, you know, multifaceted place. So just because you have similar viral trajectories in the nose does not mean that you have similar viral trajectories in the throat or in the lungs or in different parts of the body. So one of the things that might be happening is that, you know, you might be producing equal amounts of virus in the nose, but maybe it's actually the amount of virus in your lungs that's most important for transmitting. That's just not something that we had access to. So motivates a lot of other studies. Now, the other axis that we were looking at this on was people who are vaccinated versus unvaccinated. And there we actually do see a pretty clear signature that both groups of people produce similar amounts of virus, but vaccinated people clear the virus more quickly. And that's consistent with a couple of other studies as well that have come out recently, which, you know, suggests that you're probably not as infectious for as long when you get the vaccine. Now, one of the things we couldn't measure, but that another study has recently come out with, is that also it seems like in vaccinated people, even though you're producing the same amount of measurable viral fragments, basically through this PCR test, when you're vaccinated, less of that virus is viable, less of it is able to create an infection in another person. So even though you're sort of like spitting out as much viral genetic fragments, when you're vaccinated, that means that your immune system is doing a better job at sort of chopping up the virus and making it so that it can't go on to transmit to other people, which is a good thing as well. So both of those things are probably contributing to reduced infectiousness from vaccinated people too. So that's all good news.
That's great.
Yeah. So that's basically what we found. And those are some of the findings that we're trying to grapple with and figure out, you know, what do they mean now? What do we do with that?
Yeah. You know, the first thing I thought of when you were talking about the viral loads, you said that relatively the same amount, but it seems as though that maybe it's, you know, they're not quite as viable. The first image I had was like 1990s Mike Tyson's Punch Out, where I don't know if you guys have even played that, but like where you're boxing the dude, and then when he starts twirling around in circles before he drops, as if like, you know, they're getting beaten, run ragged with the vaccine, and they kind of come out, but they're like dazed and confused, they're all bruised, and they're just like wandering randomly, don't even know what they're doing. So it's a possibility that, okay, you have the same viral load, but it's not viable, meaning that it's just not quite as effective to build and infect other people. That's exactly. Awesome.
Yeah.
Was there anything that you found related to, okay, so all this data came out, it's like a combination, seemed like the UK study, the CDC talking about, okay, same viral load, but it's shorter period of time, so it still benefits us. Was there any information you did in the study or maybe anecdotal along with your research about demographics of people? Does it affect any other, does the Delta have a tendency to affect a different demographic? Like I'm thinking of children like usual, because my kids are still unvaccinated. Is there anything related, or does it still seem to be, it's the same kind of reality, but just different kinds of ways it's transmitting?
Yeah. So this is, you know, I think this is actually a good entryway into sort of how do we learn about these things as epidemiologists in the first place?
Yeah.
So the short answer is that we still don't know. We have definitely seen, you know, record hospitalizations among kids in places where Delta is surging. But again, there are two possible explanations for that. One of them is that Delta, you know, as such, is just more pathogenic in kids than previous variants. Or, you know, again, kids are much more likely to be unvaccinated because the vaccine hasn't been approved in young kids. And so maybe what we're seeing is just the relative benefit of vaccination in older age groups. So when you compare what's happening in kids to the older age groups, it looks like kids are being a lot more severely infected, but really what we're seeing in kids is what we would be seeing across the board, which is a terrifying thought, with Delta, if we weren't, you know, if there wasn't this reality of vaccination. And the incredibly unsatisfying answer is that we are not sure yet. Part of the difficulty is that, you know, and this is the eternal struggle in epidemiology, is that we can really only observe, you know, our present moment, and we can't really go back and, you know, say in the exact same circumstances that Alpha was spreading however many months ago, but compare that to somebody who was infected with Delta instead. What's the difference in probability that those two people would have, you know, ended up in the hospital or, you know, depending on their age group, because, you know, so much has changed. We're, you know, whether it's, you know, differences in restrictions, you know, in distancing, differences in masking, variation in vaccination rates, you know, the variant itself, whether or not schools are in session, you know, all of these things are profoundly changing the environment in which it's spreading, which makes it really difficult to disentangle these things. So thinking, you know, as a statistician, you know, the way that we usually approach these things is that, and you know, this runs deeper than statistics too, but, you know, we usually prefer the simplest explanation, sort of the explanation that, you know, nothing has changed until there's evidence to suggest otherwise. So that's the idea of the null hypothesis, if you go back to your stats 101 courses, right? So, you know, it's kind of this arbitrary concept, but, you know, practically speaking, what it means is that our null hypothesis here is that Delta is more infectious across the board. And we know for sure that that's the case. And then the question is that sufficient to explain everything that we're seeing? And it might be. It's going to take a lot more evidence to suggest that it's both more infectious and has different, you know, pathogenicity profiles in different age groups. Because so far what we're seeing, you know, is consistent with increased infectiousness across the board. There could be other things in play, but we just don't have the strength of the evidence that we would need to overturn that sort of null hypothesis.
Okay. You know, going back to, you know, is number one, it's just still kind of a scary thing for us, because we just try and figure out what should we do as children, you know, with our kids. And it's hard when you say you don't know, because it's school's in session. Now, thankfully, we're homeschooling another year and that helps a little bit, but we have a wedding to go to in a couple of weeks, and we, you know, all three of them are unvaccinated, and so this kind of gets to the other thing. So my kids are unvaccinated. Millions of kids are unvaccinated who are obviously younger, like my 6, 5, and 3. your best course of defense is to wear a mask, right? That's what I can do, right? And social distancing, yep. right? If you have to go out, right?
Yep.
And wash your hands and all that kind of stuff. So playing devil's advocate here in the sense of, in light of your study that you guys found, like potentially that roughly the same viral load, Delta, Alpha, but maybe one of the situations is that it's the quality of the virus that's actually causing the infection and not necessarily the quantity. Right. Now, when I'm thinking in my head, going back and reverse engineering why wear masks, it was because it was the quantity. The focus was on quantity. And so that a mask helps reduce that quantity because it's not perfect. But now right. if it's now quality, maybe, then it seems like it's a possibility that masks may not be quite as, and it's still effective, right? No matter what, it's not like it's still protecting you, but it seems like Delta can chip away at the effectivity of the masks a little bit. If it is the quality, I'm exaggerating here, but if it just takes one particle to infect you, which again, that's not what Steven's saying, just theorizing, then it can get in, sneak in, and then bam, my kids are infected, right? Is that a possible scenario that could be likely in Delta and causing part of the surge? I get it. It's a different ball game this summer. People are out at the pool. People are kind of forgetting this pandemic. People are being a little more. So there's that whole behavioral issue. But right. even us who are being protected with masks, we could be even more vulnerable with masks.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's one of the really important things with Delta is that it's sort of chipped away at all of the precautions that we normally take. Now that, as you rightly say, it hasn't eliminated them. Masking is still helpful because, it's not a single viral particle that's going to infect you. And so if you imagine that a mask reduces the amount of virus that you spread out into the world by some, by some percentage, you're still reducing that percentage, and so it's going to reduce the probability of infection by that same amount. It's just that Delta's infectiousness has ramped up that much more too. Ultimately, again, the rule of thumb that I usually use is we think that Delta is probably about twice as infectious as the original, SARS-CoV-2 that we've been dealing with, and probably, 1.5 times more infectious than Alpha. So that I've basically been, dividing all of my precautions by two now, basically that the amount of time that I feel comfortable spending in a space is reduced by about that much. It's the amount of protection that I assume that I'm getting from my mask and that I'm giving to, principally that I'm giving to other people by wearing my mask, is reduced by about that much. If I'm infected, I'm likely to infect about twice as many people as I would have infected, 12 months ago. And so that's kind of the rule of thumb. And that sort of helps me to get a sense of agency around this, where it's like, it's not that it helps to avoid this sense of panic that like, oh gosh, we're back at square one, nothing works. Everything is, everything is awful. And it's true, Delta is a very formidable virus. It's incredibly infectious and we need to live in that reality. But I think that it's still true that like all of the things that we've been doing are still effective. We just have to be on top of them a little bit more than we were.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been hard. I was talking to a friend/acquaintance the other day and I could tell where he sat, with his, COVID and the political situation. And it was just so hard to take. And I'm like, the evidence seems overwhelming. But then when you get things like this is where I think it becomes a difficult reality. One of the articles I read was how the media isn't necessarily portraying the gravity of breakthroughs and the possibility because we're trying to constantly advance the cause of like, no, get the vaccine. And no, Stephen, you've always been great being in the middle of like, no, the vaccine's absolutely indispensable and there's breakthroughs and now you hear people about breakthroughs. And so I read articles from friends who are conspiracy theorists and see even the media agrees that the vaccine's pointless. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is just like mind boggling to me. They can take something like a headline and clearly didn't read it and not extrapolate it and hold these things in tension that they're absolutely indispensable. Thankfully, before we recorded, Stephen, I told you that the FDA, I got a tweet saying FDA grants full approval of the Pfizer vaccine. So my hope, this is a big day because I know I've had a handful of people in my small networks just say, look, I'm not taking the vaccine, not because they're like conspiracy theorists, but they just want to wait until FDA approval. That's their check mark and they're okay. Right. So my hope is that this is going to unlock a wave of people to start taking the vaccine because we've realized, and I'm going to have another question to you in just a second, because this is going to be a flip side of what I'm just about ready to say, because we're seeing that the majority of infections are in places by which vaccine rates are just incredibly low, right? Missouri, mm-hmm. Arkansas, Florida, Mississippi, all these places. You know, I know Oregon's suffering tremendously right now, but a lot of those pockets are in low vaccinated places. So all the more to help people see the truth to get vaccinated. But here's the outlier. Maybe we need to circle back to this about Israel, right? Israel is just like, they are the poster child of vaccines. And from what I'm gathering, they're suffering a surge. And, you know, and maybe you can help explain it. My guess is maybe they were early adopters of the vaccine. Could it be mm-hmm. waiting a little bit? And so it's among your guys' discussions, how do you guys make sense of that when we're here saying, hey, you know, Arkansas, the reason why you're so high is because a lot of it's because you're unvaccinated.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, I've been really trying to stay away from drawing too much of a causal link between, yeah, you know, like you know, this particular geographic location is getting hit hard at this particular time because of X, Y, or Z, because I think that really lulls us into this false sense of security. You know, where I'm sitting up here in Boston, Massachusetts. And I think, you know, you can get caught in this sense of like, oh, well, it's happening there because vaccination rates are low and it could never happen here. And we have fallen into that trap way too many times this pandemic for that to be, you know, it's illogical, you know? And like you said, you know, we have cases surging in Israel. Thankfully, the vaccine is largely providing a lot of protection against severe disease and death. Yeah. You know, that remains the truth. And that's the key. There is evidence, you know, it's, as you said, they're early adopters. And so probably some of that protection is waning. Part of the difficulty is that, you know, since the vaccines were prioritized in the highest risk groups, those are also the people who have the lowest levels of immunity at this point from the waning. So they're the most likely, if the vaccine protection has waned, to end up in the hospital. And so we're seeing an additional boost from that, and why some of these breakthrough infections are probably additionally severe, because among vaccinated people, the people with the lowest levels of immunity are likely to be the ones who are originally at most risk of severe disease. So we're sort of in that weird situation right now as well. But again, I think the critical thing is that, like, you know, we are going to continue to see surges, potentially major surges, in places that have high vaccination rates. And nobody, you know, nobody can consider themselves, you know, totally immune or totally, you know, safe from, like, this pandemic is not over. We're really hoping it would be.
Yeah.
I know. Right. And that, you know, it kills me to say that, right? Like I want it to be done so badly. And that's, you know, that's what we've been busting our tails to try to do. But the reality is, like, it will continue to spread. And I think what the data from Israel shows that, you know, even with high vaccination rates, we're going to continue to see surges in cases, and we're going to have to figure out how to deal with them. Again, you know, surges in cases no longer mean exactly what they did before because of the protection from the vaccine against severe disease and death. So we're going to have to start to get used to seeing surges in cases and maybe reduce our level of alarm at that, because they won't translate into the severe outcomes at the same rate as they were before. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, part of the reason we're seeing an early surge in the southeastern US is because it, you know, lower vaccination rates generally, you know, but it's also a lot warmer there. So people are spending a lot more time indoors. That's going to change, you know, and a lot of the rest of the country, our indoor season is coming up here in the fall and in the winter. So I totally expect another surge up here, you know? And so there's this real danger in sort of this smugness that we can get, that, like, oh yeah, well, you know, they're suffering because they, you know, whatever, or don't have, you know, aren't getting vaccinated, and it's their fault. And it's like, no, this is not that. We've been down this road too many times before, and it's counterproductive, and it'll catch us flat-footed, and it's just not good. So
yeah. And you know, now I want to get into it. Before I get into this, I want to talk about the waning, right? This idea of waning and the idea of this, the rise of talking about boosters, right? I've seen a lot of headlines promoting boosters. I've also seen a lot of headlines saying epidemiologists have a second opinion. Thankfully, I've got you on here so I can talk about whether you think. Before we do that, just to clarify to everyone, because I see this often over and over and over, we know that the vaccine isn't as effective as it was at the very beginning when it comes to the Delta variant, and people throw around that 43% as if it's like some dramatic, terrible number, and that you have like a 50, 57% chance of having something bad happen to you, but just that qualification, that 43% is only about infection, right? It's just the infection, right? The still hospitalizations, they're in the upper 70s, 80s and onward, right? It's pretty high. Right. So it's still a very high percentage that protects us from that, which we're actually trying to stay away from, right? So I want to make that clause. I want to go now straight into this idea of waning, right? I'm hearing this idea that it's about the 8 month mark. I'm not sure if people are getting this, and maybe I need to be corrected. People are saying, oh, it looks like about 8 months. Now it depends on what you're talking about. Pfizer, Moderna, I have no idea that there might be a sense of waning beginning to surface. And so there is this desire for booster. Of course, now I'm thinking about my mother-in-law and should she get one in October or November? That's one thing, pragmatically speaking. I didn't show it to you, Stephen, and maybe you did see it. It's like Futurism website or whatever. I don't know what it was. So probably not credible, but they showed a map, and I don't know where they got this information from, but they showed like first and second shot, and then, you know, how you get immunity pretty high on that second shot after a while. Mm-hmm. And then it begins the tail, like we would assume, I don't know how many months or years, but then they had this idea that I don't know where this evidence came from, but the third one, the booster, just skyrocketed way above even the second shot of immunity. There's a sense by which it really does a good job, that third one. So that made me all the more want to give it to my mother-in-law. But again, where do you guys stand in the light of, hey, Israel might be this, but boosters, should we be offering these? Should we be starting to get them? What are you guys considering down there? Over there?
Yeah,
up there?
So, yeah, I mean, it's still unclear. It's becoming more and more... Yeah, I would say that we're sort of converging on the idea that a third dose would be helpful, that it does sort of skyrocket your immunity and gives you longer lasting immunity overall. And this, you know, this makes sense. Like there are a lot of vaccines that we get 2, 3, 4 doses of, you know, when we're young kids, and it requires, you know, those repeated exposures for our body to finally mount a permanent response to whatever it is. So really, you know, we're talking about boosters, but another way that you can think about it is just as, you know, we're trying to sort of fine tune what the standard vaccination course should be for SARS-CoV-2. Now, one of the places where some of this data is coming from is that a number of different countries have varied the amount of time that they place between their first and their second doses. So for example, in the UK, when the Alpha variant was really starting to take off, they really prioritized getting people their first dose. And so for many people, rather than having, you know, a 3 or 4 week window between their first and second dose, many people have closer to a 12 week window. And some of the evidence coming back is suggesting that actually that longer window is providing more durable immunity to those people, that immunity seems to be longer lasting. So that suggests that actually maybe we should wait a little bit longer between the doses and maybe even give a third dose, you know, 12 weeks, 36 weeks after, you know, our last dose. And that time sort of allows our immune system to go through all the processes that it needs to go through to mount a really good memory to this virus. And it's tricky because this varies from pathogen to pathogen. You know, the way that our immune system interacts with different pathogens is so different. Like it's so specific to each one. So we kind of have to figure this out on the fly. And that's what we're doing right now. Now, the other big issue, well, there are two big issues, you know, so we're talking about, you know, third dose, second dose, you know, what about all the people who have gotten Johnson & Johnson and, you know, different, you know, vaccines, you know, what do we do there? And I think that's another big question, you know, do you boost with an mRNA vaccine? Do you, you know, how does this work? And I think that that's a really important question too. And for anyone who's gotten the J&J vaccine, you know, we're working on this hard too. So I know that there's like a lot of conversation about, you know, Moderna and Pfizer and do you get a third dose? And it's like, you know, a lot of people are feeling left out in this because like, you know, I didn't get either, you know, and I've only gotten one dose of anything, you know, what do I do? Yeah. For as far as I know, you know, the guidance isn't totally clear yet, but we're working on it. Hang tight.
When it comes to dosages in the booster, you know, I've been hearing that Moderna seems to be slightly more effective with the Delta variant. And it's you know, now you really get a taste of this, Stephen, where back in April and May, it was all about Pfizer. The Atlantic, of course, Atlantic, I'm just in love with. Just their titles of themselves. They must do a very good job at getting really good titles because their titles suck me in every time.
Yeah.
But, you know, talking about how the Pfizer gang is over and this idea that back in the spring, there was the Pfizer gang. Like, the Pfizer was the premier stamp of approval, right?
Right.
If you're Pfizer, like, you are good. And now we're seeing that Pfizer isn't quite as effective with the Delta compared to now the Moderna. So just goes to show, it really doesn't matter what you get because you can't predict the future. And it could be like 5 months from now, it's AstraZeneca or J&J that's actually knocking it, right?
Right.
And, you know, some of it off the, so you just don't know. So, you know, I'm like, okay, well, all I can go is with my baseline, what I know. And with my mother-in-law, McKay, you know, I would kind of fight for her to cross over the barrier. She had Pfizer and, you know, get a booster that's Moderna, right? That kind of stuff to help get her a long way. So these are all the considerations I'm working on and seeing, you know, my kids and not being unvaccinated and a wedding coming up in a few weeks and seeing the increase of, yeah, COVID, sure. But we're talking off the record that RSV is kind of raising its ugly head, right? And it's causing a threat to young kids who, I don't know how much, I would imagine it has to be rare, super rare, but getting the combo kick in the butt.
Right.
Where they get COVID and RSV, and that's causing some problems when you have two. So, you know, really, I guess my PSA, and I'm just, here I am, just a layman, I know nothing about this, but I'm just taking my advice from things I've read and interpolation from Mark and Steven, and that is like really focus on, you know, this is another winter to really focus on the boys getting a flu vaccine.
Yeah.
You know, and then when and if the vaccine comes available for youngins to really to go for that, because the last thing I want is, you know, we talked about this last year of having the potential combo of getting the flu and COVID at the same time. And I think that potential can cause a wreck. So just that, consider that as we're getting in the fall, all those kind of things. Any last words for you? Anything to...
Oh, yeah. Just, you know, circling back to the third dose thing. I mean, I know one thing we haven't really touched on, at least on this episode, is like the issue with vaccine equity too around the world. And I think that that's a huge issue we have to play into too. You know, we've been talking mainly about the epidemiology of it, and probably ideally, you know, everyone will have, you know, multiple doses of a highly effective, safe vaccine. But, you know, there are so many places around the world where, you know, vaccination rates are under 1%, you know? And so then the question is like, does it make sense to be giving relatively healthy 30-year-olds in the United States a third dose of Pfizer or Moderna when there are 80-year-olds, you know, all over the rest of the world who haven't gotten anything yet? And I think that that's a really critically important question and something that we have to weigh. So that was just a little addendum I wanted to put into what we've been talking about to make sure it didn't get
that's
lost.
I'm glad you said that. One thing I want to end on, totally random. We talked about this. I think it's fascinating. Last fall, University of Colorado, where I worked, not at the University of Colorado, but I worked on that campus, and they did, I don't know if all universities did this or not. I feel like they were maybe one of the first, but they did the wastewater testing, right? And so all the dorms, and they could really easily determine whether there was an outbreak in the dorm and lock it down. Seemed very effective. I heard it's like cost affordable, that kind of stuff. And so there was another article that just came out just proving the effectiveness down to the point of even houses, individual houses and units could determine. And that's a powerful reality. And, you know, I'm so gung-ho with technology, Stephen. I don't really sometimes think of the ethics behind it. So I'm like, yes, technology, sweet. But you were talking about how this could be a great, you know, as an epidemiologist, this sounds great, but this could be a slippery slope and cause some concerns for people, you know, and some privacy issues, right?
Totally. Yeah. So I think that, I mean, what I want to start with is just like the possibility of wastewater surveillance for COVID and for other pathogens is, you know, the potential is huge. It's great because it is the most passive of passive surveillance that you could do, you know, and so, you know, it doesn't require anything of the people who might be infected or infectious. You're literally just monitoring sewage for traces of the virus, and you can get pretty good, you know, pretty good pictures of if an outbreak is happening in a given location. You're right. You know, CU was really in many ways a pioneer in this technology. You know, we're able to detect outbreaks in dorms before anybody came down with symptoms. And, you know, that's great. That like really revolutionizes our ability to manage infectious diseases like this. I think we're going to see a lot more of these kinds of things as we move forward. Now, one could envision a future in which you have a little virus monitor that's sitting, you know, at the sewage outflow of every household in the United States. And so then it gives, you know, a little ping to whoever's in the house and, you know, says like, somebody, you know, might be infected. And, you know, we recommend, you know, here are the different resources you have and the different precautions you might want to take. And on the one hand, that's great. You know, that gives you a lot of power and, you know, you can figure out what to do with that information. But I mean, this gets back to the age old question in public health is like, how do you do surveillance well? How do you do it anonymously? How do you do it in a way that doesn't infringe on people's privacy and freedom and in a way that, you know, ideally can't get easily corrupted, you know, like, yeah, I think that could end up being also a slippery slope. If you have information on the level of individual households or even individual people, you know, that in times of crisis, that might make a lot of sense. You know, sometimes yeah. we need those kinds of responses, but as constant sort of surveillance, you know, could be great, but I could also see it being a little bit dangerous in the sense that it might provide, you know, depending on who has access to that information, it could lead to all sorts of stigma or, you know, restriction of yeah. basic rights. And you know, I'm always trying to look ahead to, you know, we have, you know, this is a respiratory virus that we've, you know, been dealing with for a while. And so now, you know, it's like, okay, COVID, we're used to living in a world where COVID is spreading. And so it's kind of hard to imagine, you know, this really being twisted, but you can also imagine like a year ago, especially when, you know, tensions were really high around this thing that could have, you know, led to some real backlash, you know, imagine your neighbors yeah. find out you have COVID or something and imagine that it's, you know, a different yeah. kind of disease that spreads in a different route, you know, all of the stigma around HIV or around, you know, whatever, yeah. like what if it was something else? What if it was a disease that, you know, like HIV, it was highly correlated with, especially when it was first spreading, with sexual orientation and you weren't out to people, you know, who were in your neighborhood or, you know, like all of these things, the questions and the complications layer upon one another in a way that sort of blows my mind. So the technology is hugely, hugely promising. And I think we, as with any new technology, we have to be very, very mindful about how we use it in a way that is, you know, maximally effective and has the minimum chance of really backfiring.
Man. Well, you just summed that up again. Once again, it's complicated, right? Because we're dealing with human beings and it's efficiency is one particular thread, but it is definitely not the only thread. So thanks for sharing your thoughts on that. I appreciate it. I think we'll end there. Those of you who are listening, thank you so much for joining us this week. And again, we strive to do this every single week whenever we can. And if we don't, there's usually a big reason, because we want to be available as much as possible, particularly during this time of Delta. And who knows what'll be next in the next 6, 8, 9, 10 months. My one piece of solace, and I'll send this one more your way, Steve, before we end, as a quick response. I heard that with this particular kind of virus, like all viruses, it can be like this, a lot of mutations, but eventually it stabilizes down the road. And it's like this isn't expected to be like this forever, that at some point in time it's going to mature and find a more routine method of mutation. Is that something that is a hopeful anecdote to end on?
Yes, I think so. And I think that's likely. Eventually it will sort of explore the space of different mutations that it can have, and it'll find it kind of probably reach its, you know, happy equilibrium. That's what I expect. And so we got some more work to do yet before then, but I think there is hope. So,
okay, great. We'll end on that. It's a nice piece of hope. Thank you all for tuning in. If you want to support us, patreon.com/pandemicpodcast, one-time gift, PayPal, Venmo, all in the show notes. Please give us a review. You can email me, matt@livingthereal.com. Send us some good wishes. What's going on in your neck of the woods? Bruce, I'm thinking of you in Australia right now, just because of hearing a lot of stuff going on right now. So I'd love to hear what's going on in your neck of the woods. Have a wonderful week. We'll see you all next week. Take care and bye-bye.